of Bhagavad Sandarbha. The text under discussion is from the beginning of chapter 87 of the 10th canto, the prayers of the personified Vedas, in which Parikshit Maharaj asked his question, how can the Vedas, the Shrutis, directly describe Brahman, the absolute truth, which has no qualities and is not supposed to be possible to be described in words? The Vedas consist of words, and they describe, those words describe the qualities of material nature. So how can those same Vedas describe the absolute truth? That was the question. We've been discussing up to this point in the Anuchedha that ordinary words can't, but the Vedas consist of spiritual sound. They're not ordinary words. So discussion is how the Vedas are able to actually describe the absolute truth, Brahman. We're up to 97.8. We're making a distinction between ordinary language, which is called Paurusheya, words spoken by, written by an ordinary being, and the Aparusheya, words of the Vedas, which have no author, which are eternal and perfect. So the point's going to be made now that even ordinary words, even imperfect words, can sometimes describe the absolute truth. If ordinary words can do that, why not perfect words? So here we're on 97.8. Tadevam paurusheyasyapi vachaso bhagavat charitvam siddham. This proves also that even ordinary human words can refer to the personality of Godhead. Yatoktam yasmin prati shlokam abhadyavadyapi iti. As is stated, even if there is incoherence in every verse, tadvad visargo janataga viplavo. This is Narada's words, his instructions to his disciple Vyas. Those words which describe the glories, the names and the glories of the personality of Godhead, can create a revolution in the world. Yasmin prati shlokam abhadyavadyapi. Even if there's incoherence in every phrase, that means the text is very imperfectly composed. But if it glorifies the Supreme Lord, then it has transcendental potency to change the world. That is describing even ordinary language. In the Vedas, there is no imperfection of grammar or of style or anything. No imperfection. A finite being writes something, there might be some mistakes in it, grammatical, stylistic. But even so, those words can describe the absolute truth, and such descriptions are revolutionary. Continuing. Tasmat sakshadapi charantyeva shrutayaha. This being so, what then to speak of the words which have no human author? Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped a sentence. Tatacha sati tata vida vacha adinam ek ashrayasya sakshad bhagavan nishvas avirbhavino aparusheyasyapi tacharitam kimuta. This being so, what then to speak of the words which have no human author, which appeared from the breathing of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and are the only basis on which all such ordinary words and so on rest. Thus the Shrutis refer to him, and do so directly. The Vedas are the original words, the original language. The idea presented is that, not only here, but throughout the Vedic literatures, is that all language derives from the Vedas. They're not only the oldest books that anybody wrote down. They're the origin of all language. Ordinary human speech is an expansion of the Vedic language. So the argument, the logic given here is, if ordinary language can somehow sometimes describe the personality of Godhead, the absolute truth, why can't the original perfect language do that? And now it's being further claimed that they do it not indirectly, but they literally describe in so many literal words, they actually describe the Supreme and his qualities. Vakshite cha kvachid ajayatmana chachadato nucharin nigamaha. This will be stated in the words that come later in the prayers of the personified Vedas, where the Vedas say, sometimes the Vedas can recognize you as you sport with your material and spiritual potencies. So sometimes the Vedas do recognize and describe the personality of Godhead. Tatacha pranavam udishyoktam dvadashe. And it's been, similarly, it is also said in the 12th canto, referring to the syllable Om. Om is the original syllable from which all the rest of the Vedas expand. And Om expresses the absolute truth too, but not in an obvious way. If you look in a dictionary, what does Om mean? It's just a sacred syllable. It doesn't have a dictionary meaning. But actually, it's describing Hare Krishna, the absolute truth, and all his qualities. Swadamno brahmanop sakshad vachakat paramatmanah sasarva mantro upanishad veda bijam sanatanam. This is describing the Om in the 12th canto. That ultimately non-material and imperceptible, this is heard by the Supersoul without his possessing material ears or any other material senses. So Om is there, that sound is there at the beginning of the creation. Who hears it? Who's around to hear it? The Supersoul hears it at the beginning of creation, Om. And he doesn't have any ordinary ears or senses, not material ones, but still he perceives the Om. The entire expanse of the Vedic sound is elaborated from that Omkar, which appears from the soul within the sky of the heart. It appears from the Supersoul. Om is the direct designation of the self-originating absolute truth, the Supersoul, and is the secret essence and eternal seed of all Vedic hymns. And then also, that was from the 12th canto. Point is that even the syllable Om is describing the personality of Godhead. And then Shrutau cha, another statement in Vedas and Shruti. Om ityetat brahmano nedishtam nama iti. Om, this is the closest name of Brahman. The word is uses nama. Om is the name of Brahman. And it's the closest name, most direct name. This word nedishtam. Nedishtam lakshanadi vyavadanam vineti ityartha. Well, nedishta, or closest, means without the intervention of metaphorical and other kinds of indirect reference. We've discussed this various times about the different uses of words. Words can describe things directly, or they can be metaphorical. I can say David Doctor is a lion. He's not literally a lion. He's figuratively a lion. And then there's also suggestion made by words, not expressed, but suggested. So there are different kinds of levels of meaning. But Om is directly, it's not just metaphorically or suggestively the name of Brahman. It's directly describing Brahman. And that's the Vedas, the Upanishads, telling us that. Actually, Om Ityetat, that's not the Upanishad, that's the Rig Veda. I think Rig Veda, let me see the footnote. Om Ityetat Brahmano Nishtam. Oh, I don't have a reference for it. Anyway, it's supposed to be Vedas. Ata eva kena cha prakarena sakshad charanti sakat katyatam ityeva rajavi prayaha. Thus the idea in the King Parikshit's mind is, please tell me the way in which the Vedas directly refer to him. So Parikshit's not really doubting. He's asking how. The real point of his question, katam, how can be rhetorical. How is it possible? It isn't possible. But that's not the sense of the way Parikshit's saying it. He's not doubting that it's possible. He's asking, what's the way that they do? How, in what way do the Vedas describe the absolute truth? Atra shabda nirdeshyatve doshas tvagure dyupataya ityatra parihariyaha. In this connection, it will be later on refuted that there is anything wrong in his, the absolute truths, being described in words. In the verse beginning, dyupatayaha, someone may still have the prejudice. The absolute truth, it should be so elevated that words shouldn't be able to get near him. So it's an insult to try to describe the absolute words, absolute truth in words, to bring him down to that level. Some may have that prejudice, but that will be defeated in the verse beginning, dyupatayaha. Let's discuss that. That's mentioned in the, explained a bit in the commentary. So let's read the commentary. Description of the Supreme is not a monopoly of the timely Vedas. I think it's timeless, not timely. Yeah. Let me, I have to make a note. Okay, starting in that again. Hmm. Description of the Supreme is not a monopoly of the timeless Vedas. Any human being, even today, can receive power from the Supreme Lord's Chit Shakti to be able to use his own words to explain the Lord effectively. One may be an imperfect person with imperfect ability to express himself, but the grace of the Lord's Chit Shakti raises him above his incapacity. As the most perfect glorification of the Supreme Lord, Srimad Bhagavatam assures, and the Bhagavatam says, that even an imperfect person can glorify the Lord effectively. Tadvad visargo janataga viplavo yasmin prati shlokam abhadyavatyapi namanyanantasya yashon katani yat shrinvanti gayanti grinanti sadavaha. That production of words, which is full of descriptions of the transcendental glories of the name, fame, forms, pastimes, etc., of the unlimited Supreme Lord, is a different creation, full of transcendental words directed toward bringing about a revolution in the impious lives of this world's misdirected civilization. Such compositions, even though imperfectly composed, are heard, sung, and accepted by purified men who are thoroughly honest. No one created the Vedas, not even the Supreme Lord himself. They, like the Jivas, are co-eternal with him. But as his external expansions, the Vedas are the external expansions of the Supreme Lord. They do appear in the material world. They expand externally. As his external expansions, the Vedas express the Supreme Lord's infinite intelligence. When he appears as the Purusha, within the material creation, they emanate from his breath, as the Jivas emanate from his glance. Mahavishnu is lying down, the Jivas come out of his glance. Also describes that from his breathing come the Vedas. And because the Vedas are direct expressions of the Supreme Lord's intelligence, they have full power to describe him directly. They are not limited to indirect reference, but still may sometimes use words figuratively by lakshana and vyanjana for poetic effects. It's not that the Vedas never use indirect reference. Just like poetry takes advantage of going beyond the literal meaning of words, but still the words have to have a literal meaning. Before you can add figurative poetic meaning to words, they have to first of all have a literal meaning. And the Vedas also use poetry. Some things about the Lord, such as rasa, the tastes of reciprocation between him and his loving devotees, are much more adequately described by poetic suggestion than by the bare meaning of literal words. Just saying prema, prema does not really evoke pure love. But a poet who has pure love for Radha Krishna can use the devices of his art to share his experience with his audience. It's a sort of axiom of poetics that rasa cannot be directly described, not literally. You have to evoke it, you have to get an echo of it in the hearer's heart by using the power of suggestion. Okay, the personified Vedas said, sometimes the Vedas can recognize you as you sport with your material and spiritual potencies. This is the last line of the first verse of the prayers of the personified Vedas. that the question and answer by Parikshit and Shukadev are the introduction to. This verse will be discussed later on this anuchet. So this whole verse will be discussed in paragraph 14 ahead. The verse beginning Dhyupatayaha is the very last statement of the prayers. It will be discussed in text 97.32 to 35. So we'll get the explanation of that later on. Okay, any questions?
This particular definition of Om, many times we hear that the Om is the source of all. Here also mentioned that the Veda's source is Om. What about the word Krishna also comes in the word in Vedas, Rama also comes in the Vedas. So will this be also to say that the source of Krishna is Om, the sound?
No, Om is the source of all material creation.
Here it mentioned that Om is the seed of Vedas.
Of the Vedas, yeah. Well, we can say that the material world is created from sound. We don't say that about the spiritual world. The spiritual world is not created. The sound is there, but the whole spiritual creation existence is there eternally. So I wouldn't say that Om, that the spiritual world, Krishna or anything else in the spiritual world, comes from any from the Vedic sound. We can say that about the material creation.
There is a statement made here that Om is a seed of the Vedas. And if somebody asks, like some Mayavadis are outside, that the Vedas also has Krishna name, so here is a statement, Om is the source of all the Vedas. I'm not talking about material creation, but how do we answer them, you know?
Well, I don't see a contradiction there. Of course, Krishna is the source of everything. Everything is Krishna's expansion. You know, the spiritual world expands from Balaram, who is Krishna's expansion. But we're talking simply about the Vedas themselves, how they evolve. The transcendental sound begins as a seed. Just like we say a tree came from the seed. You can say, well, no, the tree actually comes from God. Well, that's understood. We're just talking within the limit of the tree's own life. You know, it starts as a seed. Of course, the seed has a previous source, and ultimately it's the Supreme Lord. But the Vedas, just as the Vedas, they begin as a seed. And the original seed of the Vedas, from which the rest of it grows, is Om. Om grows into the Gayatri Mantra, and from the Gayatri Mantra, the rest of the mantras expand.
One more question.
It's the seed, but the seed has, you know, a creator behind it, but that's the seed of the Vedas.
Would you hear another statement made, Om is a name for Brahman, like, as usual, is this Brahman refers to Krishna or Absolute Truth, like, because many times we hear in Prabhupada's purport, Om is an impersonal representation of Krishna.
Well, yes, it's a more or less impersonal.
So here a statement made, Om
it's
is the name of
Brahman.
It's a
statement made in the Vedas, and the Vedas, most of the Vedas don't talk openly about the personality of Godhead, only in very small special sections of the Vedic literature do we find direct glorification of the Supreme Lord as a person. Especially in the Upanishads, it's mostly a less personal description. Even when there's description of Ishvara, usually he's not named specifically in the Upanishads. So I think this Om Ityeta Nedishta Nama comes directly from the Rig Veda, I think. I can't find it right now. So it's not going to name Krishna. You don't see Krishna named directly in the Rig Veda. It's just the style of the text that it's coming from. And yes, Om is more or less an impersonal representation. It doesn't it doesn't openly, in any way that we can see, describe Krishna's personal qualities, his activities, and so on. You know, his name Govinda tells us something about him as a person. The name Om doesn't seem to tell us anything about him as a person. So at least the way we, as far as we can perceive it, it seems to be impersonal.
Mm.
But it is Krishna's name.
Mm.
Under the surface, beyond what we are able to perceive, deep, more deep, it is Krishna that's being glorified. Because it's, Brahman is also Krishna's name.
Mm.
But it's a Gauna name. It doesn't describe openly his personal, his personality.
But when it is written that Om is the name of Brahman, Absolute Truth, how the audience will understand this Brahman, Absolute Truth refers to impersonal, not to Krishna, the personality? That is always been a question in, you know, many places. Here also, I was thinking like that.
Well,
many places also like this. Like, at least like in other sampradayas, they use the word Brahman. It is obviously it refers to Krishna, but here there is a kind of.
Well, usually we understand. You know, we can't be pedantic and say impersonal, impersonal, impersonal every time the word Brahman comes up. But we understand it's a convention in our sampradaya. The word Brahman refers to the impersonal realization.
But sometimes, rarely it is used to Krishna also, isn't it sometimes?
Not much.
Like Atato Brahma Jikyasha, things Prabhupada.
No, but that's the Vedanta Sutra, which is not openly personal.
But Prabhupada uses that to refer to Krishna. We should know, understand Krishna.
Maybe, sometimes. But in the Vedic literature itself, the way the Upanishads use the word Brahma, because the Vedanta Sutra is a commentary on the Upanishads, we can see when we study the Upanishads that the term Brahma is used to refer to the Absolute Truth in a not very personal way. When we want to describe him as a person, which means to understand his activities, his qualities, and then we give him a personal name. There's a very, very restricted list of qualities that are described about Brahman. That it's eternal, infallible, pure, like that. These are impersonal qualities. So it's not just us, but the Upanishads themselves use this term Brahman to give the impersonal view of the Supreme. Notice that this verse. Oh, that's not the same verse, but in the 12th canto, the same Om is called that which described Brahman, Paramatma. It calls him both Brahman and Paramatma. So here, Jiva Goswami, in this section of discussing Om and discussing Brahman, or this whole question of how the Vedas can describe Brahman, Jiva Goswami is not segregating that we're only talking about impersonal Brahman. You know, it's the same question. How can the Vedas describe impersonal Brahman? Well, how even more, how can they describe personal Brahman? Well, because if they can't describe even impersonal Brahman, how are they going to be able to describe personal Brahman? So, for Jiva Goswami, we're not talking only about impersonal here, not in this context. So he may be mixing, you may see Jiva Goswami mixing up Sakshat, Bhagawan, you know, he's talking about Bhagawan as well as Brahman here in the same section.
Yeah.
Because in this section, Jiva Goswami doesn't see that the distinction makes a big difference here.
Mm-hmm.
They were talking, the question actually has to do with both.
Yeah.
It's a question of how can we describe Krishna? How can the Vedas describe Krishna? How can they describe Paramatma? How can they describe Brahman? It's a question of what can the Vedas do this? And it applies to the Supreme in all its aspects. So sometimes we have to, you know, in a certain context,
yeah,
we just have to keep it general.
Yeah, yeah.
The supreme truth, and we mean Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan in some context. Sometimes we mean all three at the same time.
Yeah, that's a bit kind of.
It may be confusing, but
at least
I mean, the Vedas themselves or the Vedic literature doesn't keep it cut and dry. It's not always black and white. Sometimes the term Brahman could refer to the absolute truth in all its aspects,
okay,
just in general sense.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Proji, this one line is mentioned here. Sometimes the Vedas can recognize you as you sport with your material and spiritual potencies.
Yes.
But
Ajaya Atmana Chacharato. Yes.
So, but we have heard that Krishna doesn't contact with material potency, material energy. Material energy is so shy that she feels ashamed to go in front of Krishna.
Well, this consorting with his, playing with his material energy must refer to his avatars when he comes into the material world. Even then, he doesn't actually contact anything material. He brings his own spiritual energy with him. He doesn't take a material body. He comes in his original spiritual body, and he doesn't really come under the laws of material nature, but he seems to. He puts on a show of coming in within the limits of time and space. In that sort of figurative sense, he's consorting with material energy. When he descends in his avatars. Okay. Yeah, please.
A short question about, you mentioned that in Vedic literature there are no imperfections, but we can see, for example, in Srimad Bhagavatam, sometimes like Acharya, they call it Arsha Prayoga, some usage of words which are not exactly correct, Vishnu Bhaktis, or some not exactly correct form according to the grammar. So should we see it as an imperfection or decoration or ornament of the literature in this way?
Words that are not grammatical, are they an ornament? Something?
Is it an ornament of the literature to use this kind of imperfections, or it's a fault in this case?
Well, I don't know if we can say that it's it's a virtue or an ornament. In the textbooks of poetics, usually a fault is a fault. It's not like a poet can be ungrammatical and be glorified for it. He can be excused for it. But it's not that bad grammar is a kind of poetic device.
So in the case,
grammar is what is the rules that are laid down for language. It's described in the Brahmanas, ancient, the original Vedic texts, that at first the demigods didn't have any grammar. They just used the words freely. And because of their elevated consciousness, they didn't say things improperly, even though they had no grammar. But then as time went on, it got a little more confusing. So the demigods asked Indra to compose a grammar, and he wrote the first grammar book, the Indra grammar, even before Panini. And then from there on, rules were imposed about grammar. But the rules of grammar are just a description of the way that educated people speak. If people speak differently, then the grammar changes. Panini's grammar has had such an influence that it's fixed the standard of Sanskrit grammar for the last several thousand years. But if the demigods or somebody decide to speak in a different way, then the grammar has to describe what they speak. So if a great sage or a liberated soul speaks in such a way that seems to be against the laws of grammar, that's his privilege. He can redefine the language. And we call that Arsha Prayoga. It's the privilege of great sages that they can change the grammar. Let's not say break the rules. Let's say they change the rules. They say it the way they want to say it, and that becomes the standard.
So, and because Srimad Bhagavatam describes many different pastimes from previous ages and so on, many different stages, so it's not amazing that we can see these differences of grammar or the rules. So it's actually not an imperfection in these cases.
Yes.
Right?
It's not that that there's that much bad grammar in the Bhagavatam. We have this big book analyzing the grammatical irregularities in the Bhagavatam, but most of them have some grammatical explanation. There's very few cases of actual wrong grammar in the Bhagavatam.
This grammatical explanation, are they coming from Paninian grammar or from previous
sometimes grammars? Sometimes it's not strictly Paninian, but still uh-huh. There's an explanation.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Panini was simply describing Sanskrit as it was used in his time. And he also recognizes different dialects, that the Easterners say things this way, the Westerners say something else. So he saw that language is variable. It can change according to time and place. I think we'll stop early today. I'd like to prepare properly for tomorrow and be able to present it properly, rather than jump ahead into the next paragraph. Okay. So we'll stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Спасибо.
Thank you.